Hello and welcome to this podcast from Polity Books. My name is George Miller, and my guest in this programme is Charlie Beckett, who is the founding director of POLIS, the journalism and society think tank at the London School of Economics Media and Communications Department. Before that, Charlie built up 20 years' experience as a senior journalist at the BBC, LWT and ITN. He is therefore exceptionally well placed to examine what he calls the most challenging journalistic phenomenon of the internet age, the rise of WikiLeaks, an organisation which has contested all the traditional methodologies of journalism while also seeking to collaborate with traditional media partners. WikiLeaks, News in the Networked Era, written with James Ball of The Guardian, looks beyond the personalities, so prominent in the day-to-day coverage of a story in which WikiLeaks itself often became the story, and asks profound questions about the future of journalism, about its responsibilities and purpose, in an era in which anyone with a laptop and a smartphone can break a news story to the world. Was the advent of WikiLeaks a game-changing event? Does it offer a new model that is sustainable? What has traditional journalism, already undergoing profound change, learned from the WikiLeaks experience? And what are the implications for democracy and freedom of speech? These are just some of the questions considered in this book, which Clay Shirky described as essential for anyone interested in the future of free speech or global politics. When I met Charlie at the LSE recently, I began by asking him to take us back to 2006, when WikiLeaks first appeared on the scene.
WikiLeaks has changed all the time over its history. Even the name is misleading. When it first started back in 2006, WikiLeaks wasn't actually a wiki like Wikipedia, in that it wasn't created by lots of people collaborating. It was very much driven by the vision of Julian Assange himself and his idea of, born out of his hacktivist experience back in Australia of computer hacking, that he wanted to create a platform where people could leak stuff, could send stuff without any risk of the source being revealed. So when it started, it was a kind of Dropbox. It was somewhere where people could take secret information, give it to WikiLeaks without WikiLeaks knowing who they were. And WikiLeaks' only task then was to verify that it was a genuine leak, it wasn't just a bit of fiction, and then they promised to put up it up on their website, regardless really of what it was about. And so you had a very curious mixture in the early days of some stuff which was quite politically important, such as the Kenyan leaks about corruption there, but then you had other stuff which was more trivial really. For example, the kind of the rituals and rules of fraternity societies in American colleges. So it started off as what sounds like a relatively simple exercise, although in fact was technologically quite complex. And it was relatively successful. There was quite a steady stream of leaks, although nothing of the explosive nature of the great 2010 leaks, when you get this massive amount of material about the Iraq, the Afghanistan war logs, and then of course the embassy cables. And these all allegedly stemmed from one person, one American soldier who leaked this incredible amount of material, the biggest leak of classified information in history, all stemming from one person, allegedly Bradley Manning. And this was absolutely unprecedented, and our first whiff of it was when the so-called collateral murder video came out with this extraordinary, never-seen-before picture of an Apache helicopter, an American Apache helicopter, in combat, in Baghdad, killing people. And we were given an unedited 40-minute piece of video and a shorter, edited version where WikiLeaks had done some editing, they'd done some research, and there are lots of captions on the video. In other words, very much more like a traditional piece of documentary television. And that was the moment when WikiLeaks changed its operation entirely.
Because that points to potential bifurcation, doesn't it? Either you amass this material and put it out there and allow other people to do the sifting and to find the stories, or you intervene in some editorial form, you shape, you sculpt the material, and you put it out as a story along the lines of the conventional traditional media. And that was a sort of bifurcation, wasn't it, for WikiLeaks?
Exactly. That's the point when WikiLeaks moves on from what was, it was always a relatively pure model. If you think about it, WikiLeaks was contextualizing the leaks in the past on its website. It was acting as an agency. In that sense, it was a bit of a filter, but suddenly it now moves into a completely different stage where itself becomes more like a traditional journalist. And then, of course, when it moves into this collaboration with very much mainstream journalists like the New York Times and the Guardian and Der Spiegel, then the process becomes what I would call network journalism, which is this hybrid media, this collaborative work between traditional, commercial, mainstream journalists and institutions and the outlier, the alternative, the organization which I would still describe as journalistic, but now operating in this asymmetric collaboration between WikiLeaks and these other newspapers.
So what drove that step to collaborate with traditional mainstream media on the part of WikiLeaks?
What drove Julian Assange to collaborate with mainstream media, quite simply, was the desperate need for attention. Previously, he had been extraordinarily critical of what he saw as the complicit nature of mainstream media with the kind of power and authority that he was seeking to challenge. But what he discovered was that although he was getting a lot of clicks on YouTube for the collateral murder video and plenty of leaks were coming in, it wasn't having any impact. And bear in mind that Assange was certainly not doing this for publicity or profit. He was doing it because he wanted to change the world. He wanted to have an impact on politics, diplomacy, and military activity. And it wasn't having any impact. Mainstream media wasn't really picking up on his stories. And although the Pentagon was very cross about the collateral murder video, it wasn't truly threatened. So he knew that by working with mainstream media, he was able to exploit them, if you like, in the same way that he was able to exploit the internet and use that to distribute widely and effectively the material. He was then able to exploit mainstream media's brands, their profile, their audiences, and their influence. He was also able to exploit their skills, their resources, the fact that they had legal systems of protection, but perhaps most importantly, they had the journalistic skills to filter this information, to extract what was most newsworthy and impactful, and this is really critical and overlooked, to put it into a package, a format, that the public could pay attention to and that the public could then indeed contribute to and look at the material and suggest other reasons why it mattered. So all that data visualization, the headlines, the background articles, all that was really critically important to making the leaks effective as journalism and as journalism with a political purpose.
And that, I suppose, sort of points towards essential qualities of traditional journalism having some kind of value, not being swept away by the internet age. I mean, I was quite struck by the fact that when they tried to crowdsource the redaction of a lot of material, they couldn't actually get enough people that they could trust to do it. So they came up against this, you know, this obstacle of actually turning what they had, as you say, turning it into something which the public would actually sit up and take notice of without the traditional skills of journalism.
Exactly. This was this process of opening up the information and hoping that the public or other experts would somehow pile in and filter it and come up with nuggets of editorial gold. This very much pushed this idea of crowdsourcing to the limits. And I think most people would accept it didn't really work. There are two reasons for this. One is actually that although a lot of this material was unclassified, it wasn't necessarily top secret stuff. In itself, it gave you an overall picture and a narrative and an insight into the structures of power and the dynamics of power, but it didn't actually have a whole series of killer stories of a kind of Watergate momentum. And so, in a sense, I spoke to historians who found this material very valuable, but they weren't necessarily always front page headline material. So it was actually the journalists who were able to contextualize some of this stuff, contextualize it in its relevance perhaps to a previous story, or to contextualize it geographically, so that a story which may not have been particularly explosive in Washington may have had quite a serious impact in Delhi. And so we saw how this material represented a challenge to power, not as one explosive moment, but perhaps more as a process, both in terms of detail that it showed about the kind of deals that that diplomats make, or the ways that armies actually operate when they're in the field. So it's the detail of that, I think, rather than an overall indictment. And indeed, from an American point of view, whilst the Americans were the most offended by this material, I think that actually, in many ways, their diplomats certainly came out very well from the embassy cables.
Now, clearly there were personality clashes, there were big egos involved, and there were difficulties in actually keeping these partnerships together between WikiLeaks and the traditional media. But more than that, would you say it highlighted really a different way of doing things and a different way of seeing the world, the tensions that became manifest?
It's very difficult with WikiLeaks to separate out the institution, if you like, from the person who really does run it, which is the founder and editor-in-chief, as it were, Julian Assange. His personality dominates that organization, has shaped it, and he, frankly, makes the critical decisions. So when you saw the tensions between mainstream media and WikiLeaks during that period of collaboration, one has to say that it was a dual tension. There was a personality clash with just about everyone. I think Assange's strengths are his weaknesses when it comes to collaboration. He doesn't like to debate, he doesn't like to share decisions, he doesn't like to take advice, and that, even in the strange and weird and wonderful world of journalism, which is full of eccentric people and big egos, meant that that partnership wasn't really sustainable at a personal level, although all the editors I have spoken to are very willing to work with Assange and WikiLeaks again. But there was a more fundamental clash, if you like, between editorial processes, but perhaps more importantly, ethics. In other words, the balance of risk and how far, if you're an institution like The Guardian or The New York Times, you have all sorts of responsibilities along with the rights that you claim as a journalist. You have responsibilities to regulators, to the law, to your advertisers, to politicians, to your readers, and indeed even to your journalists, the people you employ, that this is an institution that you want to be profitable and to be sustainable. You don't want to risk all that for one story. Conversely, WikiLeaks has been entirely risk-friendly. It doesn't have a commercial investment, it doesn't have a relationship with advertisers and so on. And ideologically, it was prepared to take risks with its own existence. And frankly, ethically, it was less mindful, it was more careless of the risk to the people actually involved in the stories. The idea that revealing names and information might literally physically put people at risk. And indeed wider, that it might put, for example, diplomatic processes at risk, diplomatic processes that might be working towards, you know, conflict reduction, conflict resolution, very noble things. And Assange and WikiLeaks were much less mindful of those risks. And that makes them quite a different ethical editorial entity. And in a sense, they certainly at that stage felt they could take those risks, because they had a certain immunity. The fact that they weren't based in any particular country, the fact that they didn't have, for example, a board that would make them accountable, like an NGO, for example, or a private company. And the fact that the internet and their ability to move information around meant that they were effectively immune from the kind of prosecution and restrictions and limitations that are imposed on mainstream media.
I mean, it's interesting you call it an entity, because organization doesn't quite capture the nature of it. Because in many ways it's closed, it's non-transparent, it's stateless, and it's kind of extra legal. All of those things make it very different from the traditional media you've just been talking about.
I think it is, in practice. It is this unusual hybrid entity. Now, of course, even on the internet, nothing is entirely free. The internet is a structure, and ultimately that means that eventually anything can be controlled on the internet. WikiLeaks is made up of human beings who live in the physical world. And so eventually, if people in power, people or the law, can eventually be enforced, and in practice they can make life so difficult that it is impossible for an organisation like WikiLeaks to operate. That's not the case at the moment. I think that where WikiLeaks has struggled, it's struggled mainly because of its own internal weaknesses and internal contradictions and its failure to build a sort of sustainable model. But there is something in this, and it's a, if you like, it's a traditional dilemma for alternative media. Do you stay outside of systems? Do you stay outside of the law? And that gives you a certain freedom, both ideologically to attack and criticize, but also, you know, commercially and legally to be free to an extent. Or do you collaborate? Do you get closer to power because you were trying to have an influence on it? And I think this is something that Julian Assange hasn't ever really resolved in his head. For one exceptional moment in 2010, there was a synthesis of the two. Here was what he billed as a challenge to power, a major challenge to the systems of power, that was effective partly because it collaborated with organizations, mainstream media organizations, and it seemed to be about as effective, frankly, as journalism can ever be. And of course, when we assess how effective WikiLeaks has been, we must remind ourselves that, of course, journalism media is just that, and in itself, it doesn't change anything.
We saw that WikiLeaks wasn't immune to outside control when Amazon.com, PayPal, MasterCard, Visa withdrew their services from it. What were the forces you think that were in play when that happened?
I don't think we'll ever know quite how conscious and deliberate the corporate campaign against WikiLeaks was in terms of its relationship to the American administration or the American authorities. In a sense, that doesn't matter, really. I think that you can see that one of the dangerous things about the future of the open internet is the degree to which corporations will see their interests coinciding with other people in power who also want to restrict freedom on the internet. And I think that's probably what happened. Of course, the point about it is that whilst WikiLeaks has enjoyed playing the role of victims and said that they've been persecuted and hampered and restricted by this assault by Amazon, the assault by PayPal and so on, in fact, the lesson is that it survived and that it was able to keep leaking. And I think in that sense, it showed that at the moment, at least, it is in practice theoretically possible as well that you can persist with this immunity.
Yeah, fragile but resilient is kind of a running theme in the book, isn't it? It seems that it can't go on, and yet it goes on.
Yes, it is very fragile. It's partly, one has to return to the Julian Assange role in this, that any organisation that is so dependent on one person, despite the fact that there are, you know, collaborators who have been with Assange and WikiLeaks for many, many years, and there is this whole very supportive network of hundreds of thousands of people across the world, some of whom are expert journalists, some of whom, if you like, are ordinary citizens. So it still does have a very strong brand and a very strong base. And I don't think that, you know, necessarily it's going to end anytime soon. But I think the challenge for it, and I talk about this in the book, is how is it going to be sustainable? And does Julian Assange really have a sense of what it's going to be? And whilst one wants to avoid trying to put it into a pigeonhole, for example, is it an NGO? Is it a traditional piece of alternative radical media? Or is it some kind of new networked hybrid model? Well, it doesn't have to have a label to work. It may be the case that in the networked era, this kind of political journalistic enterprise will be somewhat liminal, operating at the edges, somewhat transitory, somewhat protean, changing over time. And that may be its effectiveness, or at least that may be the way that it exists.
And is it too early, do you think, to point to its influences? Have we seen copycats or other organisations learning from the experience of WikiLeaks and doing things differently in different situations?
I think one of the interesting things about WikiLeaks as a challenge to journalism, if you like, has been the way that it has very much forced all journalists, those, you know, radical alternative journalists right across to commercial mainstream journalists on the Wall Street Journal, to think again about their work, to think again about its political purpose, its ethics, and so on. And what you get is you get straightforward copycat websites, who, you know, various dot leaks type websites, and then you'll get somebody like the Wall Street Journal, who also create a secure Dropbox for people to leak stuff to. But of course, each one is very different according to the ideology and ethos of that particular organization. And what's interesting, I think, and it is still very early, really, to think about the consequences of WikiLeaks, but in a sense, I'm surprised by the lack of leaks. I'm surprised by how, you know, the traditional function of leaking in journalism, well, it's been around forever, and that will continue, of course. But the idea of exploiting the new technology to create a secure Dropbox, which is untraceable, where the source is untraceable, and that would therefore lead to a kind of tidal wave, an avalanche of leaks, well, that hasn't happened. And it could be because people feel intimidated. It could be that authorities have tightened up their systems. But it seems that the era of the whistleblower hasn't actually arrived, that systems haven't opened up and people aren't, you know, pouring forth with deep secrets. Quite the opposite, in a way. We've seen groups like Anonymous and Lulzsec, the kind of hacking groups, and they aren't whistleblowers. They are breaking into systems, often in a criminal way. And, of course, you know, the authorities are fighting back against them quite effectively, actually. So we're seeing some people, in a sense, trying to imitate in their own image what WikiLeaks has done, others being more radical, pushing harder at trying to break into information networks. And so, in a strange kind of way, WikiLeaks is looking a little bit more mature, perhaps, a little bit more like a compromise, and at the moment hasn't come anywhere near emulating the global reach and the high profile of those 2010 disclosures.
Clearly, WikiLeaks came along in a context in which traditional journalism was already changing dramatically. Has it simply speeded up that process? Do you think traditional journalism has learned and indeed benefited from the WikiLeaks period?
Well, looking at this from a very British-centric point of view, we're in the midst of a whole reappraisal of the sort of ethics of journalism, thanks to the phone hacking scandal and the subsequent Leveson inquiry, which has gone much deeper and wider as an inquiry into mainstream journalism than we've ever had before. And I think in that sense, WikiLeaks does fit into the whole sense that journalism is being turned upside down. That's primarily about the business model. But I argue in my first book, and I argue in this book, that there's something much more profound going on, which is that journalism is having to rediscover its purpose in society, not just how to make a profit, but what's it there for? What does it add value to? How does it contribute to the idea of citizenship and democracy and political communications? And as the wider political communications are being literally revolutionized, I would say, by the internet, by social media, by social networks, and how we're seeing those new forms of political communications impacting directly upon, for example, you know, the so-called Arab Spring, but also more widely thinking about the Occupy movement, thinking about even the riots in England in 2011. We see that social media is having an impact, and these new technologies having an impact in a way that journalism could only have dreamt of in terms of its influence on events and the way that people think. So journalism itself is starting to fit into those other networks of communication and reportage and analysis. And WikiLeaks, I think, was a huge wake-up call to journalism, not to imitate it or copy it necessarily, but if journalism was critical of WikiLeaks, it had to explain whether it was doing the job properly. Was it holding power to account? Was it trying to discover truth? Was it really trying to reveal things that power doesn't want the people to know? And I would say that In many ways, it had lost that mission. And it's a mission, if you like, that needs to be eternally rediscovered.
I suppose one wanted to end on a balanced note. One could say that both the new journalism and the old journalism reflected each other's shortcomings back at them.
That's right. I think that WikiLeaks did force mainstream journalism to do two things. Firstly, to acknowledge that the claims it makes for truth, the claims it makes for its democratic role, are questionable. Inevitably, it often fails and it's often doesn't live up to those ideals, and it must renew that mission, if you like. But there was also a secondary warning, if you like, from WikiLeaks that mainstream journalism wasn't innovating properly, that it wasn't really responding to the internet in this kind of intelligent, speculative, enterprising way. But finally, I think the sort of lesson out of it was that mainstream journalism has to adapt, has to learn to open itself up, has to network with a whole series of new partners in a new kind of participatory journalism. And it can be individuals, it can be citizens, but it can also be organisations, not just governments, not just commercial organisations, NGOs, but other forms of journalism, other forms of political communications, which are starting to emerge and are being part of these networks in the digital era that journalism has to start tapping into, not just to exploit them, but also to give value back to them. And I think that is ultimately the challenge for journalism, to reinvent itself as part of these new digital networks.
I was talking to Charlie Beckett about his recent book, written with James Ball, WikiLeaks, News in the Networked Era, which is out now in hardback and paperback. For more details, visit the Polity Books website at politybooks.com. That's all for this Polity podcast, but I'll be back again soon with more interviews with Polity authors, including John Thompson on the present state of book publishing, which, like journalism, is facing profound change in the electronic age. I'll also be speaking to economist Peter Nolan about whether China really is buying up the world. Do also look out for a growing number of videos on the Polity website. I hope you can join me again soon for our next podcast, and until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.